Thank you very much, Sarah, for the nice introduction. So what I'm going to talk about today is mean field theory for non-equilibrium network reconstruction. This non-equilibrium part that I have put in the title is because most of the new parts that are not published are going to be about non-equilibrium system. However, I start with describing equilibrium models first. So let me just start by this sentence that probably you learn in the first lectures in statistical physics, which is correlations is not a connection. So two things can be correlated but not be connected to each other. And a very nice example of it is this Meerschaert law, which states that the vote share of the German Social Democratic Party equals to the index of the crude steel production in the Western Federalist States. It's been observed by this gentleman in 83. And you can see that, you know, it has a predictive power, like, you know, it goes on and they very much coincide on top of each other. But rationally, you don't think that there is any direct connection between the votes of the German Social Democratic Party and the crude steel production, but there might be some underlying dynamics that are affecting both or whatever. But as you know, this is an example of two things being strongly correlated with each other over years, but yet, you know, obviously not being directly connected to each other. In you know, systems biology, we have this recording technologies that, you know, we'll put this micro drives on the head of the rat, and the rat runs around. It can record from tens of neurons, or you can just gene cheap microarrays that you can measure the expression level of thousands of genes at the same time under different conditions, and, you know, you end up with spike patterns like this, or gene expression levels like this. And what people do is either look at individual genes at a time, individual neurons at a time, or, you know, look at the pairwise correlation between neurons. But observing the covariation of the activities cannot directly tell us about the network connectivity. It can tell us about a lot of things. But if you're interested in understanding what is the circuitry from this type of activities, observations, it's not a direct link. So the question I want to address in this talk is, can we use this type of data to infer connections? And the way I'm going to do that is, first I will use a toy model, which is equilibrium inversizing problem, and I will describe how it can be studied and fitted, and I will talk about its shortcomings. Then the rest of the talk, I will talk about fitting a kineticizing model to various approximations, and I will develop mean field theory for fitting that kinetic model, and we can quantify the errors analytically and also through simulations. And then I will talk about real data, how these things can tell you about circuitry in real systems. So equilibrium inversizing model, and probably all of you know, is you consider a network like this of spins plus minus one, and there's an external field coupled to each spin, and there's a pairwise interaction between them. You know, usually in the statistical physics, you are given a model like this, a Gibbs distribution. You are given, you're asked, what are the correlation functions? Basically, what is statistical physics is about. Through various approximations. The inverse, that would be the Ising problem. The inverse Ising problem will be, well, you have the correlation functions. Now, what are the couplings in the external fields that give you this? You know, in the machine learning community, you know, it's called also Boltzmann machine, or you could also put it in the framework of graphical model learning, but for physicists, we usually call it an inversizing problem. So, how can you find? I mean, if the system is a small, n is a small, you have an n body problem, and you can solve it analytically. But when n is large, how can you solve this thing? The way people usually look at it is a Boltzmann learning. So, there's an exact algorithm that is, you're probably most familiar with it. You look at the mean magnetization and pairwise correlations according to your data. You choose a setting of couplings and external fields. You calculate the mean and pairwise correlations given the current values of the couplings and external fields, and you adjust the the couplings and fields iteratively until you converge with a learning rate eta. Sorry? Yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah, but now I'm not talking about neurons. I'm just talking about a system, an Ising model, and I want to reconstruct it. So you can do that, and that converges, and that's an exact algorithm. And it's been proposed by Sejnovsky and Hinton and Hackley in 85. But the trouble with this algorithm and any other algorithm of this type is that it takes a long time. The problem mainly comes from this part where you have to calculate model statistics. And you'd have to do that for large n using Monte Carlo sampling, and that takes a long time. Secondly, you have to also do this gradient descent, which if you start from an initial condition that you don't know, that is not really close to your start to the solution, it could again take a long time. And this eta parameter, there is no automated way of finding it. You just have to play with it around and fix it to some value. Sure. Yeah, because, yes. But given the means and pairwise correlations, there is only one Ising model that fits that, because because it's a convex optimization problem. I mean, you have an exponential of a bilinear form. You will find it. You will find it gradually, but it can take a long time. So that, even if you don't have that, you will again, if you have a pairwise, if you have n spins, you observe m out of them, and you have mean magnetizations and pairwise correlations, there is again only one Ising model. Okay. If you have, I mean, whether you think or not is a different thing, but this is a true statement, because this is a, you have an e to the power of something. If you have a correlation matrix and mean magnetization, there's only one bilinear form that can fit it. It's like you have a mean and a standard deviation. There is only one Gaussian that fits it with the same number of parameters. Now, if you allow marginalization, that is, you consider other variables other than the, of course. Okay. If you allow hidden variables, then that's true. Yeah. If you get other things, hidden variables, that's what I'm morally assuming. You have n spins, n means n pairwise correlations, sorry, n squared, n minus 1/2 pairwise correlations, and you want to infer an Ising model over these variables. And that problem can be solved exactly. Now, the thing is, this is difficult, but you can develop fast and reliable approximate methods to do that. I will describe them very briefly here. I mean, the simplest thing you can do is an independent pair problem. It's like what Sophie said. You just assume that these things that you are seeing are the only pairs, okay, and you can solve it. That's a two-body problem. You solve that exactly, and you inverse it, and you get the couplings and so, yeah. I'll get that. No. I'll get to all that. Yeah. Let me just now. I'm talking statistical physics. It's complete. I will talk about whether that's useful, whether it is not, and all that. Sure. And it's not only this problem of inverse Ising model goes back to the 70s. So from a statistical physics perspective, it's a very interesting problem. Now, whether it has to do with neuroscience, I will talk about that in a minute. You can do a high absolute magnetization expansion, assuming that these guys go to zero. You get the formula like that for the external fields. You can do a naive mean field theory, which is you start by writing out the mean field equations for the magnetizations. You apply the fluctuation response theorem, and that gives you a this equation, which is basically the couplings between any pairs of neurons, is the negative of the inverse of the correlation matrix. And you can extend than this. You can write the tap equations, which are more complicated than this ones, and they incorporate this Onzaga reaction term, and you can apply the fluctuation response to this. Then you get a quadratic equation that has two solutions. One would be physical, the other wouldn't be, and you pick up that one, and that gives you the another approximation to the inverse problem. There are more complicated ones, approximations. There's a Sysak-Monasson expansion. It's in 2009. A very elegant paper was written by Victor Sysak and Rémy Monasson that they derived another expression for this inverse problem. You can use belief propagation. These are algorithmic, again, to find out the inverse problems. An extension of belief propagation called susceptibility propagation, which shows a very interesting dynamics that we show in this paper. There are all these methods that you can apply to the data and find out what you get, the JIJs. So for neural data, now I go to David's question. So suppose you have a bunch of neurons. You can discretize this. You can look at the spike beam, the spike trains. To find beans of delta t, put zeros and ones, sorry, one and minus one if there is a spike, and if there is no spike, correspondingly, and then you get a binary representation of these things, of the spike patterns, where you can calculate means and pairwise correlations, and you can ask the question of, you know, what is the pairwise model that fits that? And that is what people usually call them functional couplings, that thing that you get there, and this is basically the simplest probability model for the spike trains that satisfy mean and pairwise correlation. So again, to David's question, I think the first thing that is interesting is that this is the simplest model you can play with above an independent model. Whether it's good or useful, I will get to that. But it's a stage that in history has to be passed. And it is the maximum entropy distribution given the means and correlations. And this is the work basically Schneidman et al. And Schlenz et al. And a lot of other people did, and they fitted that type of model. Sorry? In the sense that it has the fewer, it is the first model that takes into account correlations. I mean, you can't, it's yeah. It is minimalistic in that sense. I mean, you have independent model that each pair is independent. You're here, you're assuming that all correlations in time are independent. Well, I mean, that I would call a more difficult model, because it has a dynamics and it has all that. This is a simple, like, binary. It's as simple as an Ising model is for a magnet, I would say. I mean, that's it. In that sense, it's simple. So how good are these approximations compared to exact learning for neural data? So we generated data from a simulated network of excitatory and inhibitory neurons, Hodgkin, Huxley. They interact with each other. There's feedback between them. And you can see how these approximations work. So this is what you learn from the Boltzmann learning. And this is a naive mean field solution for a population of n equal to 20 out of 1,000, okay? So at n equal to 20, all these different approximations work kind of good, okay? For small populations, basically anything you do is good. The differences appear when you go to bigger populations. And in that case, you see that none of these ones are good. The TAP and Sysak-Monasson are reasonable, and interestingly, for whatever reason that I don't know, their sum divided by 2 is the best one. I don't know. But anyway, but these are at least reasonable, and you can at least use them for initiating Boltzmann learning. Okay, it saves you a lot of time for that. So, and this shows the error of these things as population size, that you can see these ones drop very fast, whereas the happen, the SOC monozone and their combination, they kind of stay at a decent level. Sorry? I've compared, so I generated data from a simulated cortical network. I learned through the Boltzmann. Then you ask the question now. Yeah. So we have fast approximations that we can apply on these networks. We can learn the best Ising model. But the question is, what does that best Ising model tell you? Is that, why do you do that? Unless out of, I mean, except for being curious. So you might ask the question, what is the relation between these couplings that you inferred and the real connectivity in the network? So I first, let me give you a couple of success stories, which come from, this is a paper by Lazon et al. They looked at the microarray expression data from this thing, and they tried to reconstruct the network by just inverting the correlation matrix, so the naive mean field approximation to this thing. And they got a connectivity pattern between different genes that apparently coincides with the pattern that people have found using different biological techniques. So they declared it as a success story. And it's not only this one. I mean, you can look at the proteins, and if you look at evolutionary conserved protein sites, you can and look at the correlation between those using an inference, the reconstruction of not an Ising model but a POTS model in this case, you would be able to reconstruct the protein complexes and the residues. And so these two are very encouraging, and there have been a lot of work in this. So for neural data, however, I mean, this is the network that I generated because I know what is connected to what. And I inferred connections. And, you know, there is no.
So this is
this is no, this is out of 20. Well, this is not all there, but if I look at everything, it's the same. Basically, in this, there's a property of this equilibriumizing model, which is the following. If you look at the larger populations, I don't have the figure here, but if you look at this PRE paper we have written, if you look at larger and larger populations, so you have 1,000 neurons, say, and then you look at 20, you fit a 20 spin Ising model to it, and you increase that. Basically, the connections would stay, would all get multiplied by a factor. So the relative amplitudes remain the same. So it's there's a multiplicative factor that it's a scaling factor, and the reason for that is you can argue with that for a mean field argument. If you have a network that the net effect of the others is essentially a random field. Yeah. So it's a kind of a mean field argument, and that, therefore you are basically getting the temperature wrong. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So, but in any case, what you get is that neuron to neuron basis, you don't get any information about what is connected to what. I don't really remember, but it should be exact Boltzmann learning. We have tried all of them, and this is a very robust result. I mean, independent of the population size or all these things. But this is not an Ising network. So there is essentially two reasons you can think about it. One is that you're forcing the connections to be symmetric. Connections in real life and networks are not. The other thing is that there's an equilibrium versus non-equilibrium. So your Ising model is a good example. If you have an Ising model and it is in equilibrium and you fit an Ising model to it, you get the right J's. But if you look at it in a transient, or if it's driven by some external input that is not even a stationary, but it's not it doesn't reach equilibrium, then you don't get a Gibbs distribution. Okay. Here, we've done it with a lot of different things. We had filtered noise. We had Poisson noise. We had neurons that are driven. The argument is really simple. The thing is that even if you have an Ising model, if you look at it before it equilibrates and fit an Ising model to it, you don't get the right J's. So there's no reason a priori that this should be the case, and you see that it's not the case. So the equilibrium inverse Ising model is not a good model for inferring the connections. Now I'd like to open a parenthesis, a rather big one, and ask a second question. Is it a good probability model? So you could ask that, okay, this probability distribution that I found, there's some J's there. I don't care whether they coincide with the real synaptic connectivity or not, but I wonder whether that probability distribution is a good approximation to the probability, this probability distribution that I fitted only with the knowledge of mean and pairwise correlations is a good probability distribution for the data. So and that motivation came from Schneidman's paper that this is not probability, it's kind of frequency. So you compare, this is a probability of observing a particular sequence, like word. This is an independent model, and this is a pairwise model. So if that model was exactly explaining the data, everything would have been on this diagonal line. This is a log scale. And you can see that the independent model does very bad. The pairwise model does a pretty good job compared to the independent model, at least. And you can see that in other, this is a very surprising result, because if you look at other networks, other preparations, methods, the other papers, you get the same thing. The difference is the color code, though. They really look the same, right? So this is kind of surprising that there is such a strong support for going from an independent model to a pairwise model. So there's a quantitative picture of this too, where what these people do was to compare the KL divergence between the true distribution and the pairwise distribution, so the true distribution of this words, and you normalize it with an independent model. So you get a measure, basically. We call it this delta. It's the KL divergence between the data and the pairwise model, data and the independent model, which is also equivalent to the entropy difference between the pairwise model and the data and the independent model of the data. And if this is near zero, it tells you that compared to the independent model, this pairwise model is a very good model. If it is near one, it tells you that at least it's as bad as an independent model. Okay. So what does the experimental data give us for this? Well, they will give us numbers of this sort, 0.01, depending on who you look at. And that is, again, very surprising. This number is pretty small, so it suggests that pairwise models are exceptionally powerful. Well, there is a but. The but is that all these things were calculated for small populations of n of the order of 10 or 15. Okay. Now, the question is whether that tells you anything about the real system. So I've answered this in three papers. But let me tell you, just in a cartoon, what we're meaning. So you have this delta, you have this n, the number of things, and you look at the value of delta in some regime, and you find that it's small. And you'd like to know whether it's going to be small, even for larger n's, whether it's going to continue going like this, or it's going to shoot up. You'd like to answer that question. Whether this is an artifact of the fact that you're looking at a small population, or is it something telling you about the large network? So, as a physicist, the first thing you would try is to perturb, do a perturbation experiment. Suppose your model is independent, you expand around that independent model. So the parameter that you can expand here is n, the number of spins or neurons, and delta is the average number of spikes per bean. Okay. You assume that n delta is much smaller than 1. This is not a bad regime. All the experimental data were up in that regime. Okay. So n delta was around 0.01, 0.2, up to 0.3. That's the maximum people got. And of course, delta depends on the time that you time bin that you choose to for binning your data. Therefore, you know, you can always choose, when you analyze your data, you can always choose delta t to be so small that that thing is satisfied. For all neurons. Yes. Yeah, so n is 10 in these experiments. So the probability that you see in it, so it's a very high, it would be a high magnetization system. So a system that is really magnetized towards minus one. There is very few jumps to like flips to plus one spins. For the older neurons. So if you have 10 neurons. Sorry? So delta, delta is for all neurons. So n delta, is basically the number of ones in the whole thing. Okay. Yeah. Let me see. Is it averaged over neurons again? Delta is sum over. Exactly. So that quantity is the expected number of spikes per bean for the whole population. So I mean, now if you make this, so this is not very trivial. I mean, The fact that this quantity is a right quantity to make expansion just comes out of trials.
So it goes back to your MI, MJ going to -1.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's experimentally relevant. I mean, that not experimentally relevant, but paper relevant. So these papers that you mentioned, they were analyzing data in that regime. So you can calculate now this KL divergences in this regime. Okay, you can analytically do that. And a very simple thing you get is that the KL divergence between the true and the independent model is n minus 1 delta squared, and true and pairwise is n minus 1 n minus 2 delta 3. Okay, and you can calculate the factors in front of them exactly. No, I'm just assuming you have observed n neurons, you fitted an Ising model to it, okay, and I'm asking, suppose that there was a true distribution for those spins, okay? How far your independent and pairwise models are compared to that? Not a very large Ising model. You get n neurons from a distribution. You fit an Ising model to it, and you ask, what is the under general conditions, what is it? I mean, under general conditions, if as soon as any distribution. So this is a very general statement. It doesn't matter what is the underlying true distribution. Okay. Anything, yes. That's the whole point. Well, and you can get that those things that come in front of this, they depend on the differences between the third order and fourth order correlation functions of the true and the pairwise models. So those. What do you mean? I mean, I have.
I imagine that you have some network and you're thinking.
No. I'm looking at the. I assume that there is a distribution for which. There's a true distribution for which n delta is much smaller than 1. Okay. Then I assume that I make an observation out of that, and I fit a pairwise model, an independent model to it. Okay. Then I look at the KL divergence. It so happens that if this condition is satisfied, you can, under general conditions, write these things. Okay. And calculate the factors in front of them. Okay. Now you can see where it goes. So the delta, then it becomes proportional to n minus 2 delta, the little delta, which by assumption was smaller than 1. Okay. So what does that mean? It might look like a good thing, okay? But it tells you that anything, any distribution that you looked at, if you looked at it in that regime, it looked pairwise. No, there is nothing like that. It's like you get the first thing I would say is that if you're in that regime, your curve doesn't look like this. It would look like this. Okay. The second thing is that it doesn't have anything to do with what happened afterwards, independent of that. And let me show you examples of this is a simulated data again. So what I'm doing is to calculate all these things and compare the theory versus experiment. So delta t was a very important parameter because that told you about this delta, the probability. And you see, if I look at this delta as a function of n, it starts increasing linearly, no matter what. And if I use a finer delta t, I would get an even better fit. I mean, I could have thought that it's even better. So this conclusion that delta is small comes from the fact that the analysis of the data were done in the regime that n delta was small.
I'm going back to my question. For example, here, you're increasing n. What are you keeping fixed?
I'm keeping everything fixed. So there is a data generated from a network n. Okay. There is a network of, say, 1,000 neurons. Okay. I look at n of them. Yeah. And then I increase that. And I average over multiple choices of this thing. I mean, this is a critical factor that if you use finer beans, things look even more pairwise. Even more pairwise. I mean, you see that, you know, this becomes even smaller.
I mean, assuming n, so this is a subset of a very large.
Yeah.
Assuming
n, because
delta is
delta
will be not.
Then word theory will be wrong. But I don't want to say anything about afterwards. What I'm saying is that as soon as that condition is satisfied, this delta is going to be small, and the smaller delta t, the smaller that quantity. So if these people bin their data with larger time bins, they would get a different result. I mean, they would get larger values of delta, and you can see it here. I mean, I'm doing it with the same experiment. And you see that there is a quite nice match between the theory and experiment. So this slope you can calculate analytically from the statistics of the data, which I didn't show you, but you can look in the paper. So equilibrium model does not help you find the connections. It is not a good probability model for data unless you're dealing with a brain of 10 neurons or of that sort. Sorry?
A symmetric brain.
An equilibrium symmetric brain of 10 neurons. I mean, that. Okay. So, I mean, that brings me. So, David, there is no reason. I mean, unless that you have to do it to find out that it doesn't work. So, once that you find that it doesn't work, let's ask the question if. Oh. It came from what? It came from the fact that the connections are symmetric, and you're dealing with a non-equilibrium system. Even if the input to the network is stationary, it is not equilibrium. And therefore, it doesn't satisfy detailed balance. You don't have a Gibbs distribution. So all these notions that you have in statistical physics are gone. So I mean, more useful thing that people have been doing for a long time is studying kinetic models, like the GLMs, like networks of integrated and fire neurons. These don't assume the, you know, these things about the network, like symmetric work, and therefore they tell you more. But for a physicist, they are too difficult to analyze. So I thought that to make a simpler, like more analytically tractable analysis of the system, I would study what really like, which is a kinetic Ising model. Okay. So this has both features. It's simple, but it doesn't also it doesn't rely on those assumptions. So kinetic Ising models, you can essentially in the literature you can find two ways of defining dynamics on Ising model. One is a synchronous discrete time update rule, which is it's a Markov chain at time t there's a distribution of the spins, and given that, there is a probability that you get another distribution of p plus 1, and that comes from a distribution that is a sigmoidal like transfer function, like si of t multiplied by a field and the couplings that comes from the previous normalized property. Okay. There's an asynchronous continuous time, which is, oh, and here all the spins are updated together. So you look at the spins at one time, you go one step forward, you update everything. You can do a continuous time, which is that you have time beams of size delta t, which is very small, and time is continuous. And each spin, and you at each time, fine time spin, you flip spin si to minus si with this probability. Okay. This is the usually what is called the continuous Glauber dynamics, and that's a kind of synchronous Glauber dynamics. Okay. So they are very old stuff. So I'm going to focus on this, but everything I say is valid on that one, and Fred isn't happy, but it's not. Yeah. I mean, there is all these things, but everything I'm saying is generic enough. We have, but first we did that because it is simpler. I'll tell you. Sorry. I mean, again, so it says that I look at the spins now, I make a transition. Okay, that's a transition matrix. Now, why it takes that form? Because so this is a normalization. This is a normalization of this. I see. So this is, you get an exponential form and you normalize it at each time. Okay. What does it have to do? I'll show you afterwards. At the end of, yeah. No, that's a good, that's a fair point. I mean, I can sell this to a statistical physics community, but I should make a case if I want to publish it as a. Sorry? Say. But that's a very good point. Well, it is a maximum entropy, as you will see later. Well, you can see it even here. So you are making a maximum entropy at each time step. Yeah. Given the equal time and non-equal time and one step forward correlation functions, you are making a maximum entropy model. Yeah. But it's not a maximum entropy model of the whole. So this is a very good question. Actually, one of the reviewers asked us too. So the question is, the Ising model is the maximum entropy model given pairwise equal time pairwise correlations and mean magnetization. Is there an interpretation like that? So yes, the thing is that this is a model that given the mean magnetizations and one step forward correlation functions, it's E to that thing. Yeah, yeah. And you will see that comes up out of the, I mean, it is e to the power of that at each time step. It's like e to the power of any quantity. A beta. Oh, sorry. Here, there's a beta. There's a beta here, there's a beta here, there's a beta, me think, here. Yeah, there has to be a beta there. So anyway, I'm going to assume beta equal to 1 because I'm going to vary. I mean that only changes the magnitude of H and J, and I'm going to vary the magnitude of H and J. Okay. So suppose, I mean, again, let's do statistical physics. Suppose you have observed R repeats of length L of this system, of the synchronously updated kinetic Ising model. I denote it by this. You start from some initial condition, and now you know your H can be time varying. There is anything that can happen. Just the J's are constant. And you have observed R repeats, each of them have L lengths L. Sorry? Yeah, the dynamics of H is fixed, so H is the same. Yeah, exactly. And you want to look at this and infer the H and the J's. So the simplest thing to do is, again, to do an equivalent of the Boltzmann learning for this, write the log likelihood maximize it by gradient descent, and you know that gives you the result. So that gives you an equation like this, and you can see here already that these guys appear. Pairwise non-equal time correlation functions appear. So, and these are averages over the data. And this is averages only over the repeats. So they're time dependent for the edges. Yes, I mean, they could be symmetric too, but So this is essentially a batch version of a delta rule for n independent perceptrons, okay? And it is much faster than the Boltzmann learning in equilibrium case because you don't have to do Monte Carlo sampling. It's a gradient descent, so it's a slow still. But, and you have to calculate these sums, which could be very large sums if you have a lot of data. But you don't have to do Monte Carlo sampling, so it's pretty simple in that sense. Yeah, I mean, you can still see that your likelihood. And your likelihood is bilinear in this JSON. There is only one minima of that. So, and you can calculate the error of this by just expanding the log likelihood. What you get is that there is the mean square error is 1 over L in general. And for the limit of weak coupling, that is when the magnitude of J's is small, it will be 1 over 1 minus MI squared of L. Okay, so as L goes to infinity, you can, that's an answer to your question. So as L goes to infinity, if you have enough data, you will get the right. L is the length of the data you have. Okay. It used to be T, but then T was temperature. So. Yeah, but we put it to 1, but we decided afterwards. So L remained. So this L is the length of the data. So you have a like kind of parallel decay of the error with the length of the data. No. If you define the error in this way, no. It's a sum over all of. It's an average, so it's independent of. No, not as long as this piece. It is valid for anything. It's only true if you have weak coupling. So, this is good, but it's still an iterative algorithm, and I don't like iterative algorithms. So can we develop a mean field theory for this, like just those mean field equations that we use to infer the JIJs in the equilibrium case? So you notice that this would be a very difficult thing for a number of reasons. One is that how do you do mean field? I mean, you write the Gibbs distribution, you have partition function, you factorize it. Here you don't have a partition function because it's a non-equilibrium system. So you have to use a different set of tools which are developed by primarily by Ton Kulin at King's College, which you can study the in dynamics of spin glass systems. And it's a basically you have to look at generating functional like path integrals that can determine the dynamics of the system. I'm not going to go into the details of that unless you really want me and we have time. But let me just focus first on the stationary case and tell you how in general that could be done. So suppose this is a learning rule. I mean, this was the learning rule. Suppose that it is satisfied. So J delta J J is 0. You get that equation. Okay. Now suppose the mean field theory holds. So define m's and the mean magnetization and expand write as I as mi plus some fluctuations. Now assuming that this mean field equations hold, you can expand around this delta s. I mean write this as delta s plus mi and expand along delta s. To the first order you get this equation. Okay. Which you can simply invert, and that gives you an approximation. J mean field is equal to A inverse. Did I not define A? So A is 1 over 1 minus MI squared. It's a diagonal matrix. This is an equal time correlation function. This is a one step correlation. So this is the mean field solution to this non-equilibrium problem, the inverse problem, under the assumption of a stationarity. Sorry?
What's the goal?
Oh, the goal is to find out, but you know, this is now a very simple approximation. You can just, these are from your data, you just multiply two matrices, you have the J's. You don't have to do any gradient descent. So it's a fast way of solving that problem. Now the next step is a bit more tricky, that is the TAP version of it. So TAP version, I mean, this is usually written for symmetric systems and all that, but we verified that you can write it using generating functional for this kinetic model as well. Okay. Yeah. And you have to do gradient, yeah. So for large systems and when you have no idea where to start. So if you now assume in the same way, instead of the mean magnetizations don't satisfy the mean field equations, but the TAP equations, and then now expand to the third order, you get an equation which looks like this. It's pretty similar to the mean field one, except that this A is different. So now it is this 1 minus mi squared multiplied by some factor, which that factor comes from as a solution of a cubic equation. And where that, I mean, this is just a little bit of algebra. I'm not going to get into it. But you see, this is, a very simple simple thing. These guys you calculate from your data, you multiply them, that gives you anything. And the first thing you would observe is that jij tap is essentially jij mean field divided by some factor. So you'd expect that they are rotated compared to each other. And you can see them here. So here we generated data from a Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, so an Ising model with synchronous dynamics. Mean j is just equal to 0, the standard deviation being g squared divided by n. When you look at 10 to the power of 4 samples, this is the true ones that we generated, and we know what the true ones were. And this is a mean field and tap. So you see, mean field is this one, it's a black, and the tap is the red one. It's kind of rotated. You can see it when you have more data. You can see that, you know, this is the mean field, and tap is kind of this is underestimating, mean field is underestimating the coupling systematically. TAP is overestimating, but to a lower degree. Now, if you go to a higher order, it would change, okay, on this, until the whole series, I mean, because this is a series expansion, high temperature in some sense. Sorry? Sure. This one. Sorry. This one or the TAP one? What do you mean?
Because the 1 minus the pi is related to the sum of the jij's over j somehow.
This one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can interpret it that way. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a divisive normalization. I mean, if you think about it, this is sum over j, therefore this is a constant independent of I for large systems, right? Yeah, but since this is drawn from the same statistics for each, therefore you kind of have a constant. This will vary a little bit as a function of I. So you are basically normalizing everything by the Bayes effect. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, but that really depends on the viewpoint. Yeah, sure. No, these are very good approximations, I would say. I mean, this is a small system too, n equal to 20, but it's even n equal to 100. It's.
They both have convergence.
Yes. So there's a systematic bias that gets corrected by. So I mean, most people probably are very happy with these approximations, but if you want to write a physics paper, no one will buy it if you just show that that's a small or that's large. So you want to quantify those errors. You can do it by suppose this dij is one step equal time One is the forward correlation function and satisfies this equation at the maximum likelihood. Suppose you are in zero field, that makes it simpler. If you expand in the J's, you get something like that. And quitting J mean field as this equation, you basically get J mean field equal to the true J's minus this sum. Okay, and that gives you the error. So the error of the mean field, the squared error of the mean field is G to the power of 6 divided by N. Okay, so that's what you expect. As G increases, which is like as temperature increases or N increases, the error of mean field becomes smaller, and this is G to the power of 6. So it's, now you can see it for simulations for various lengths of the data. This is the exact algorithm. So they start off together, the mean field and the exact algorithm, but then it starts saturating depending on which value of G you look at. And the lines are the theoretical G to the power of 6 divided by N plus this 1 over L, that comes from this term. And you know, the fit gets worse and worse as G increases, which is as you go to lower temperatures. For the tap, you can do the same argument. It becomes 4 G to the 10 divided by N. And when we looked at data, we got a much larger error, which surprised us. And for a long time, John and I in Copenhagen were very confused about why this is so. We looked at any possible numerical error, and in the end, we found that there is a finite size correction which we didn't care about, which is this thing. It's 20 to the g to the power of 6 divided by 3n cubed. In general, for n large, this is smaller than this. But we were looking at n equal to 20 to be able to go to very large sample sizes. And you know, this is a small compared to this, only is n is much smaller than 1 over g squared, which is, you know, if this is 0.1, this is 100. So that has a very, very significant effect. And if you include that, you get very good fit. So again, this is the tap error. And you see, I mean, we have to go to 10 to the power of 10 data points to start seeing this knee of the error. No, but you may be able to. I mean, if someone will be in 200 years, then they will cite me. That's good. Okay, so this was all about a stationary case. You can do everything in a non-stationary case, so when H is time dependent. So this is where most of the troubles come from, writing this equation. So for the dynamical case, for the mean field, you can easily write that mi of t plus 1 is equal to hi of t, this thing, tangent hyperbole. The dynamical tap equations in this thing is a mess to calculate. And you can see it has a weird form. It is a self-consistent equation for one step forward, mi of t plus 1. But you can do it. And once you've done that, you can apply that again and get a learning rule for the non-stationary case. This is an example I'm showing you, which is one that I really like. So this is data generated from a sinusoidal field that is applied to all these spins. And we are we are using a non-stationary mean field, which I didn't give you the expression, but you can basically find the same way. And you can see that, you know, there is a very nice match between. If you really look carefully, you see that there is also a shift. There is a systematic error also here. But the funny thing is when you apply the equilibrium case to this, you see there is this apparent, it's kind of shifted upwards, which means that there are couplings that are zero really. But the mean field theory, the equilibrium theory thinks that there are connections because it can't explain them with the time-varying external field. It's a common input, so it tries to explain those correlations as a function of, yeah. Sure. Yeah. The stationary case is when you have H equal to a constant, but it's not equilibrium. That's, there are two different concepts, right? The input doesn't vary in time, and so everything is independent of time. So these m's will be independent of time, h's will be independent of time, correlation functions will be independent of time. There is no Gibbs distribution still, but observables are independent of time. Now, the non-stationary cases where this thing can vary in time. And in that case, you know, but this is very, this is the interesting thing. This is what, if you apply a non-equilibrium, an equilibrium theory to a non-equilibrium data, you get connections that don't exist, because that's one. And you can use this kind
of.
Yes, exactly. And you can see it also here. So once you found the J's, you can put them in this mean field equation and try to infer the H, right? And here is what, this is the real field, the blue. This is the non-stationary mean field that is reconstructed. And this is the stationary mean field, the other. So you see, it then underestimates the true field. So but here, in this way, you can, in some sense, reconstruct the stimulus, time-varying stimulus from observing the samples. So, well, David is not here, just to show whether these things are useful at all for real data. I mean, for in vivo and in vitro real data, we don't know the connectivity. So there's not a way to see whether, in the same way that it was for the equilibrium case. Again, I have to appeal to the in silico real data, where I know what is connected to what. So let's see. So one thing, I mean, I don't really want to sell this thing as a best model for inferring things. The most, what is intriguing is that you can develop this mean field theory for dynamical models, which are very good, you know, you have access to many of them, like the integrated time fire, GLM. These are nice models these methods can be easily applied to them through just a tougher calculation, but there is no fundamental limit. But let's just naively apply these things to simulated data from this network that we had. So here is what the interesting thing is. Look at the inhibitory-inhibitory connections. What I've plotted here is, in black, is the histogram of the synaptic connections present in original network. So I inferred the J's. I got those ones for which there was a connection in the network, and I looked at the histogram of those. And I did the same for the those that were not connected to each other in the original model. So for the non-equilibrium, see, you see they are separated from each other, these two distributions. Okay. No. So I look at the J's, I infer J's. Then I categorize Jij's to two categories. One is those pairs that in the original network they were connected to each other. One is those pairs that were not connected to each other. Yes, and I plot the histogram of those things. And you can see they are, in the equilibrium model, they are not separated from each other. Now, if you increase the data length, that becomes very interesting. These things get separated even more from each other in the non-equilibrium model. In the equilibrium model, they stay the same. Until, you know, they at some point they saturate. Now, with a very simple binary decision, you can say who is connected to who, okay? In this one, you can't, given the same amount of data. And this is one example. So there's 25 neurons out of some 90 or, sorry, some I don't know how many, any. And this is the real connections between them. And this is the inferred one, using just assuming that we knew that there is 10% connectivity, so you would be classified as the 10% larger and 10% lower. And you can see that the connection, I mean, there is a MIS also there's here, but about like 95% of the cases, you can identify the inhibitory to inhibitory connections pretty accurately. Well, let me first finish that. So you can quantify this thing as with a noise to signal ratio, which is the deviation and this thing. And you can see that as a function of the length of the data, this is the exact algorithm. And this is the mean field and tap. They kind of coincide on top of each other. So there is no real benefit from going from mean field to tap when you apply them to this in silico real data. And you know, it decreases up to some point, it saturates. And this residual error comes from the fact that you are fitting the wrong model. I mean, I am assuming that I'm fitting an Ising model to a Hodgkin-Huxley conductance-based thing with several timescales. Okay, so that is where, you know, that is the fact that I'm not fitting a realizable model to this data. But up to here, you know, so you get a reasonable noise-to-signal. So this shows this noise-to-signal ratio as a function of the length of the data. Noise-to-signal ratio is this. This is what I defined. Sorry, I just skipped it. I'm very sorry. So it's the standard deviation of this plus the standard deviation of this divided by this. How separable these two distributions are. So as you increase the length of the data, these things start going down until at some point there is no point of observing more data because your model is wrong. So whatever you see, you're fitting the wrong model. But it's still, you know, you see you can reconstruct a fair amount of connections by this. And these kind of reconstructions made only by the mean field. I mean, it's like you have two matrices, you multiply them. And another, I'll tell you that later after I tell you about the excitatory. So in the excitatory one, the same story exists. But the thing is that now this separation is really small. The reason is that the excitatory connections in this network are also much smaller than the inhibitory ones. They are weaker. Okay? So this is already a saturation. You can't get better than this with this model for the excitatory to excitatory connections because they are weak. Okay? So the noise the residual noise that comes, you know, kind of blurs the separation, and there's no way to get rid of it even if you increase your. Here, actually, in this simulation, so I tried that. So initially, we had less inhibitory neurons and excitatory ones, and we got that. Then I tried to increase them, so half inhibitory, excitatory. Still, the inhibitory, excitatory neurons should be weaker so that the network is stable. You can't, I mean, unless you tune the parameter. I mean, I'm sure if I play with these things, I can find the parameter regime that both, but that's cheating. The real thing is that strong connections with this simple mean field kinetic theory can be found, but not by the equilibrium one. Could be. I mean, could be. Yeah. But so the reason why I think that might not be the case is that when I look at stronger cases of stronger excitatory to excitatory connections, the separation gets bigger, but it's not big enough. So let's summarize. So we can develop this mean field and a tap approximate learning for the non-equilibrium case. We can very well quantify the errors of these things. And we can also extend everything to the non-stationary case. And for simulated the data, at least we can infer the strong connections. Well, I mean, to be honest, I'm really surprised with this because this model is so far from the real thing. I mean, the network that we generated, it had a lot of dynamics and a lot of, and this model doesn't have any memory. It doesn't have, it's just a Markov chain, the simplest Markov chain. It doesn't have even equal time interactions. So it would be really interesting to see what happens if you consider a little bit more complicated. Like if you take into account, so all this machinery that we presented here can be applied to a network that has memory as well. So you are not in a Markov chain, but you have a one-step, two-step memory. Okay, and it would be really interesting to see how much improvement that makes. Okay, yeah, that is also possible. I mean, that's a very decent model to start. I think it might. I don't know. So I don't know. That's one to try. Well, I haven't written down. You know, the one biggest step in all these things, which I skipped and I didn't talk about, were deriving the dynamical tap and mean field equations, which you have to do using the Tonkulin's method. And I haven't done it for the memory for the GLM case. I mean, we have done it though for the continuous time. That's Fred's question. So everything you do here, you can do it also for the continuous time. The only difference is that the tap equations take the form of dm dt plus mi would be equal to tangent hyperbolic hi of t plus sum over jij mj of t minus dmi dt plus mi. The tap. For the non-stationary continuous time. Now you basically change mi at t plus 1 to dm dt plus mi. Okay. That's a tap equation. And the mean field will be up to here. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, exactly. Because it probably is. I mean, it's like, yeah. But I believe that you can look at the memory, the case with memory as well. John was playing with that. I don't know where is the status. Well, the thing is that the maximum likelihood. These are brute force approaches in some sense. I mean, you have to do gradient descent.
Right.
You could do it here too. The reason why we do tap is that it's just a multiplication of matrices.
Right.
There is no iteration. It's immediate to solve it. So for the GLM and all these models, I think one thing one can do, and they would be really useful, would be to develop these mean field and tap equations instead of just doing the brute force fitting that we are doing. Yeah.
We got rid of that problem, but now the only computational problem is the gradient descent or the gradient descent.
Yeah.
But actually, when you bracket to there, that's not such a bad problem. So you're trying to solve the problem that I'm not.
No, I think I'm foreseeing the time that it's too big. You're looking at millions or hundreds of thousands, and in that case, I mean, you can. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's not probably for. Well, you could argue that at that time computers will get better too. So you're. So well, that's. But the thing is, yeah, I agree. But I think it's. That's what theoreticians do. Like, you have to do something, right? So that I just want to emphasize this thing, that this residual error that you get in the end comes from the fact that you're having a wrong model, and therefore I really believe that doing this for the GLM or other models, particularly those with memory, would be a really useful thing. I mean, already with this simple mean field technique, you're getting some of the connections, 95% of the inhibitory ones and some of the executory ones. Yeah. And I think that's why it would be important to have a control over the errors, however small they are. I mean, if you fit this model to the model, to the data that was generated from the same model, how much error would you have? So that's most really the main motivation behind doing those error quantification. So let me just, the future work that I think, apart from going to this GLM models and more complex models, is, I mean, within the same framework, one would like to quantify the non-stationary error, particularly for different types of stimuli. There's an issue of subsampling, which is what Sophie asked in the beginning, which you always are observing parts of the system. So for the equilibrium case, what happened was that what we observed was that you would kind of overestimate the couplings if you look at the smaller, but the relative magnitudes. In this case, I did a little bit of work, and it seems to be the opposite. You kind of underestimate the couplings. But I haven't done a systematic study of that. One other thing is that the equilibrium mean field theory was developed by writing the mean field equations, applying fluctuation dissipation, fluctuation response theorem to that, and that would give you the learning. Now, here we did it in a different way. We got the mean field equations, then we looked at the maximum likelihood condition, we expanded. One question is, you know, people in the past few years, they have developed a lot of fluctuation dissipation theorems for non-equilibrium systems. Udo Seifert has done a lot of beautiful work on that. And interestingly, some of the results we get here, you can find them by just naively get some of those fluctuation dissipation theorem and apply them to the mean field theory. So there is some kind of link, but I don't know what it is. And the asynchronous case, applying it to data and quantifying all these things, is done by Eric Huller. So this work was based on several papers that is listed here, and it was done in collaboration with several people, John Hertz primarily, and Peter Latham, and also Eric Orel in the computational biology department of Royal Institute of Technology, Joanna Tirka at the math department of Stockholm University, and Sheila Nierenberg at Cornell. And the financial support came from the generous funds of the Kavli Foundation and also at the Nordita. Thank you. Sure. Which one? No, sorry. It's a bad term. I should stop you. Subsampling, I don't mean few samples. It's a bad name I've given it. I mean observing the smaller subsystems. So instead of looking at N, a large system, I'm just looking at a smaller one. No, but L is the length of the data. How many samples you have seen?
L is time.
L is time. No. N is the bad. Yes, but except for the last ones, the application to real data, that then I just took some bunch of the neurons and I applied that to it. Yeah. The real network. The so-called real network. Yeah.
So you want, when you say issue of something, you want to have like another
integral. Yeah, I want to have a control over, if I see a smaller system, how can I make a like a prediction of what would be the weights if I observe many more?
So you had
So that weak coupling, but those are where we find these errors. So the weak coupling is when we can find analytical errors for this. But these are all about the case that you're looking at a system, you're seeing the whole system. Okay, those are the only case where I looked at the case in which we had an issue irrelevant to subsampling was when we did the in silico data, and in that case, you know, I don't know, the in silico data, the simulated in silico. So in that case, you know, it could be that if you look at the whole, well, actually these are whole system. If you look at the smaller ones, you probably get a more messy biodistribution. No. So here, this particular example is the whole thing. But I have done subsampling, and you get the same thing. I mean, this network, for instance, was reconstructed by looking at only, I think, 90 out of 400. Okay. Yeah, it's still a lot. No, I agree. But it's a decent thing to do. I mean, it's an important question to see what you can learn from small systems. I mean, the thing is, you know, you could.
But that's the
power. Yeah. But I mean, this extrapolation thing is what you would like to see. If I'm seeing 30 neurons, what can I say about? I'd like to see whether I can say anything or not. Oh, sorry. What?
This is a good candidate for a leading topic during the
Yeah.
But we have
Thank you very much.